Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You have tuned in to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio 95.9 FM, and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, your host, and as I record this, we've finally gotten some of that snow we've been needing. Maybe we'll have our water supply hold out this summer after all, do you think? Well, this week we have the newest episode of Desert Oracle Radio from Ken Lane, released March 5th, 2026. Here is Springtime in the Desert Mountains.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert during that magical time when the cold winter desert becomes an Eden of wildflowers. We luxuriate in the spring warmth. The birds are just delirious, just like that. It's springtime, or almost, way up here in the Mojave Mountains. There's nothing better than the desert in springtime. Most people say that. Up here around Pioneer Town and Pipes Canyon, it's still chilly at night. The mornings, too. A little warmer up in Landers, out in Lucerne Valley. Still cold way up in Lone Pine, after dark, anyway. The mountains make the difference. Who said that? I think it was Lee Harvey Oswald. You get close to sea level on the Sonoran Desert, where the Colorado River meets the Sea of Cortez, the Gulf of California. And it's already hot. They've already had highs in the 90s. And then the wind comes in and it's 20 degrees cooler. We are at relatively high elevation up here in the Morongo Basin, outside our famous national park, which was supposed to be called Desert Plants National Monument a century ago, when our blessed desert saint, Minerva Hamilton Hoyt, convinced one of her rich buddies in FDR's administration to preserve all that government-owned arid land around here and up in Death Valley as national monuments. The desert's answer to Yosemite, to Yellowstone. And all of that is here today and more, all saved as beloved national parks and still some monuments and one preserve. Mojave National Preserve, that bring great joy to millions every year, while providing the economic engine of little desert towns like Joshua Tree, 29 Palms, Shoshone, Beatty, etc. If you're around Yucca Valley, it's just shy of 4,000 feet above sea level in the foothills. You're still around 3,000 feet in elevation in Joshua Tree, the town, the unincorporated town. And consider this, you can go all the way up Mount Whitney in the Sierra Nevada via the Owens Valley Desert side, Whitney Portal, You can go all the way up to the peak at 14,505 feet above the Wyandark Sea, the highest peak in the contiguous 48 states. And in short time, once you get down from the peak, you can drive over to the lowest point on the entire continent, which is Badwater in Death Valley, 282 feet below the briny blue, which is safely kept far aside the Great Wall of Mountain that we call the Sierra Nevada, so you don't drown while visiting Death Valley's lowest point. Sierra meaning sawtooth, and Nevada meaning snowy, the snowy sawtooth mountains, more or less. And the most beautiful mountains in the world. At high altitude, you live a little bit different. Takes longer for water to boil, takes longer to cook pasta, rice, all those starches we don't really need anyway, do we? The onions never become translucent in 7 minutes, but they never did that anywhere else either. That was part of the big lie, the New York Times food section deception. If the air is clear in your mountain locale, well, your lungs and heart will be especially happy to receive the blessing of daily walking or hiking or biking or horseback riding or cross-country skiing through the natural highway of your choice, as appropriate to your bioregional landscape. Because you're getting about 17% less oxygen at 4,000 feet than at sea level. Less air pressure, too, by about 14%. Once you adapt, your body produces more red blood cells to compensate for the decreased oxygen available. And long term, you're going to increase your lung capacity. This is true if you're active, not necessarily if you're not. So get out there and do whatever you do. Run or walk or get on a horse. Lord knows that old horse wants to get out of the corral and explore too. We used to have horses all over the place up here in the high desert. Now I rarely see them on the trails, although there is a nice horse camp at Black Rock Canyon. Just take some Benadryl if the wildflower pollen doesn't agree with you.
Desert Oracle Radio.
But what about the danger? What about the risk? Yes, a bear might eat you on the trail in Montana. A mountain lion might eat you while you're on an early morning run in the Sacramento foothill suburbs. These things happen. Not very often. But they do happen. It makes you feel alive, too. These things happen less when you're more prepared, but they still happen. Life comes and goes, rises and falls for each of us. I'd rather fight it out with a grizzly than die in a hospital. Better yet, scare off the grizz with a couple of blasts from my good old peacemaker, because in this scenario, I am riding a great black horse through someplace like Glacier National Park on a glorious sunny day in June. Snow still on the ground, but the green meadow coming up fast. That bear knows better than to be hassling people on the main trail. Come on. So if you live around 4,000 feet elevation and on upwards from there, congratulations, only 15% or so of the whole world's population lives above 4,000 feet elevation. That means we are the elite, the elect. Soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. You ever try to read a book in a restaurant, at a bar on a quiet afternoon, and the light's all wrong? And the text printing in the book is too faint, is too small, a general decline in the presentation of the written word. I've got old pocket Bibles and pocket U.S. Constitutions with crisp, readable text and a well-printed serif font, usually some minor variation of Times Roman that has been in use since Charlemagne ordered his scribes to use a mutually intelligible, mutually readable, magical font now known as Carolinian Minuscule, which came back in the Renaissance. And it's the sort of font we most often use today in business correspondence and in printed periodicals. Times Roman is the common version we still use today. So you're having trouble seeing the page, and it is for sure the fault of the lighting, the maddening, invisible pulse of the LEDs, not your own vision naturally declining a bit over the many decades. But you see people struggling with reading glasses and those little lights that clip on the top of the book, or the candles we keep in our dark candlelit occult libraries within the menacing stone towers on the stark desert slopes. Then also at the Red Lobster or wherever we're eating these days on the interstates. But sometimes we just say, oh, to hell with it, and pull out the phone, which has adjustable brightness and crisp text and the Kindle reader, and oh, who cares? Let's check the gram, the IG, the imbecile gram. They're all right, so nobody human posts there anymore. Let's try the Facebook. Lots of unwanted pit bulls and yard sale announcements. People just finding out about the news from January, and onward we go. And then we'll switch over to Twitter and catch up on the war. I did finally finish the Charlemagne book I was trying to read at lunch down in the low desert. And this part struck me as being an apt description of the Daniel Boone type of Western pioneers who spread across the American wilderness, starting even before the Revolutionary War, but really picking up by the 1790s. That's how my own family got to eastern Kentucky from the Blue Ridge side. They wound up in Floyd County on the Big Sandy River. William Wagner Lane and James Shannon Lane and their families and their animals crossed through the gap with old Daniel Boone himself. He did that to make money, you know. He'd take people through. He had to make a living, too. Anyway, this is from Charlemagne, The Legend and the Man by Harold Lamb. It's from the 1950s, a previous century. The ancestors of the Franks had been handy with axes. Their broad-bladed axes served them well to hurl at an enemy or to clear forest. like their kinsmen, the Danes and the Norse. These pioneer Franks could turn a strip of forest into a tillable field and build a house with a smoke hole in the roof and a beaten clay floor between the spring thaw and the autumn frost. Naturally, they sought the rich soil of riverbanks adjacent to the easily traveled highway of the water, which supplied them with fish to be salted and dried for winter food. Using axes, they put together skiffs and coracles of dried hides readily enough. From Roman ruins, they obtained bricks, iron, joint bars, and possibly some lead pipe. A freeman's house sheltered his cows, pigs, and watchdog. And if he were wealthy, his horse. His wife, if she were clever, might add woven wall hangings and white linen to their furnishings of cooking pots and spits, and the hand-hewed table and bed. Being in so far self-sufficient, this freeman usually liked his farm to be independent of others. By his own river, his own oak grove. He was quite willing to walk several leagues with his family to the neighboring village to drink ale at a fair or a saint's festival. To buy his wife a mantle clasp. Or to take her to communion. By Charlemagne's time, this typical Frank was in the way of becoming a farmer more than a warrior. He clung stubbornly, however, to his inalienable right to speak in a lawsuit, to drink more than his fill, and to keep his property for his sons. Urban life appeared, to his independent spirit, to be voluntary imprisonment. On a recent episode, we were commemorating what would have been Edward Abbey's 99th birthday. Edward Abbey being the long-gone desert writer of such classics as Desert Solitaire. So Ed wasn't around for the party. He died 3.5 decades ago, and there wasn't a party anyway. You might find a paperback of Desert Solitaire with a nice stock photo of a desert landscape on the cover in your Airbnb or at the gift shop in the national park. Mostly in hopes you won't actually read it, just buy it. Abbey wrote many other books, the comic novel The Monkey Wrench Gang being his other lasting classic, a fast-paced adventure in the Butch and Sundance style, madcap. And this year marks the 50th anniversary of that book. It's about these doomed romantics who get in over their heads and pay the price. A book that is little read in environmental circles today, mostly because few people read books anymore. But also because it's funny and vulgar and full of very human characters who do not represent the best of their gender, race, faith, or anything else. But they sure are good company, which is all we really care about unless we're terminally online, unless we're bores. And they truly love their homeland. The American Southwest, especially the colorful deserts and canyons and rivers and mountains of New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah. Doc Sarvis, Bonnie Abzug, Seldom Seen Smith, and George Washington Hayduke. What a gang. Like other desert-loving teenage delinquents of that era, I longed for a gang of such wit and foolhardy bravery. I longed for secret missions and campfire oaths. I'd mostly grown out of such romantic and doomed situations, mostly, when I started seeing those newspaper reports about various members of Earth First being shanghaied into federal terrorism conspiracies. Old Cactus Ed died around then at the end of the 1980s, taken by some chronic internal bleeding illness that was never well understood, often misdiagnosed. But he was gone 6 weeks after his 62nd birthday, buried in an outlaw's grave somewhere along the southern border in an Arizona desert preserve. Gone but not forgotten, as they say. To my mind, Edward Abbey is on the verge of a revival. And Abbey offers a lot more than that paperback copy of Desert Solitaire in the gift shop. And more than the Monkey Wrench Gang, the comic masterpiece from 50 years ago. I'm especially fond of some of his 1980s collections. One Life at a Time, Please, published in 1988, the year before his death, is very relevant in the 2020s. The novel A Fool's Progress, also a later work, may not be a very good instruction manual for a life, but it's the kind of life a lot of us were headed for anyway, those of us who love that book. His fat masterpiece, as he called it. Ed Abbey was a sensitive young man wandering the world with his tattered Schopenhauer and Nietzsche paperbacks, moodily riding his army motorcycle on patrol through post-World War II Italy, brooding from Forest Service, fire lookouts, restless, romantic, unsatisfied, ever on the move, ever on the run. And that covers both of the Ed Abbey-related anniversaries of this year, 2026. May the desert mystics and hillbilly homesteaders still remember you a century from now. Where will you be in the years to come? Will you be remembered? I hope so. And remembered for good reasons, too. Fondly remembered. Where will you be in 20 and 30, which is only 44 months from now? Well, I'll be glad to be around if that's how it goes. Can't worry about it too much. It is written that the greatest warriors really live every day as if it was their last. What about desert radio broadcasters? What about underemployed philosophers who refuse to get out of the hot springs and do some productive Zoom meetings or something? I've never fought in a war, to my regret. I've done some scattered wartime reporting here and there, Balkans, Central Europe. Gotten close enough to feel both the excitement and the long stretches of boredom. I've spent long, weird nights in UN compounds, press rooms in various foreign capitals as the fighting breaks out. Years covering stateside military bases, pageants, press release events, the thrilling return of the troops to Camp Pendleton after the first Iraq War, the Gulf War of 1991. That's how writers used to make it big. They would make their breakout book about their wartime experiences. Hemingway, Norman Mailer, Vonnegut, Orwell, Tolkien, Robert Heinlein, Well, I'm probably not going to be able to follow that routine. There comes a time in your life when you have to acknowledge you're probably not going to be going to the front lines. Although the mighty pagan King Penda of Mercia, last pagan king of England, ended his long reign on the battlefield when he was supposedly 80 years old. One last glorious battle. And then his enemies cut off his head, so it goes. But we're a military town out here. Their big Marine Corps base, one of the largest in the world. So we'll cheer him on like we cheer on the USA hockey team. Why not? From Amboy to Zizix and across the Great Mojave Wilderness, this is Desert Oracle Radio, broadcasting from KCBZ-FM 107.7 in the high desert. Friday nights at 10 p.m. Or listen on your phone, on the computer. When people tell me they listen on their enormous TV sets. They talk to the TV set and it plays an episode of the radio show. It's like something from a dystopian science fiction movie in the 1960s. I think French New Wave, maybe? Forbidden Planet? I went down to the post office to pick up the mail and there was a strange little package, like a packet made of folded brown paper bag, and I was thinking, what is this? A chocolate bar? A Willy Wonka bar? Some kind of trick? You gotta be careful. People mail a lot of weird things. And then I see the handwritten return address says, in loving memory of Ray Barnes and his pals at the Virginian, long live the desert rats. And inside, it's a stack of $2 bills. Enough to take your girl out to dinner on Friday night, you know? Enough to get a new pair of boots. And besides that, they're all handsome new Thomas Jefferson $2 bills direct from the U.S. Bureau of Printing and Engraving. Very kind, much appreciated. And I'm thinking, Ray Barnes? That sounds familiar. I look up the name and there was a Danny Ray Barnes who passed away 2 years ago. If you ever had lunch on the patio of Country Kitchen in Joshua Tree, he used to play guitar and sing out there doing lots of crowd pleasers. I don't know if this is the same Ray Barnes, so I won't say more, except that this episode is in memory of Ray Barnes and his desert rat friends at the Virginian, right there in downtown 29. I've been there many times. Thanks to Red, Blue, Black, Silver for the soundscapes. You can support this radio show and podcast at desertoracle.com and patreon.com Desert Oracle. It's getting windy again. Bring in your patio chairs before they blow away. Good night from the voice of the desert.
Hey, if you're listening to this on March 8th, happy International Women's Day. It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, and streaming at kgvm.org. Well, how about some nature readings? From Nature, A Day at a Time, by author and naturalist Kathy Katz. The reading for March 8th begins, centipedes, Scutigera coleoptrata, despite their name, don't have 100 legs. Instead, they have between 15 and 173 pairs of legs, depending on the species. Separate from both insects and spiders, they are in a class of creatures of their own, Chilopoda. Their first pair of legs serve as modified fangs with poisonous claws that can inflict painful but not too serious bites on humans. They move rapidly through houses or over logs and leaves, hunting for cockroaches, beetles, scorpions, and earthworms. Centipedes reproduce without actually mating. A male leaves a package of sperm for the female to pick up, which she does, but stores it for later fertilization. After the eggs are fertilized, the young centipedes emerge with only 7 body segments, but as they molt, they add more until fully grown, sometimes with almost 200 segments. And then it closes with a quote from Max Delbruck. He says, "Any living cell carries with it the experience of a billion years of experimentation by its ancestors." So please excuse that jet that just flew over. Seems like I can't record anything outside at the cabin without a jet flying over. Well, anyway, for March 9th, she writes, "Although similar to centipedes, millipedes, Narcissus americanus, generally have much different life habits. Instead of hunting for insects, millipedes slowly graze over moist, leafy areas, eating decaying plant matter. For protection, their bodies have a hard shell, which can curl into a tight ball when threatened. Lacking the centipede's sting, millipedes have another defense system, a built-in arsenal of hydrogen cyanide, a deadly gas, which can be fired from cannon-like holes along their sides. The holes are connected to a 2-chambered gland, each storing the necessary ingredients to make ammunition. This arsenal is fired either from specific ports or all at once depending on the attacker's position. Not all millipedes have this potent arsenal, but all release a strong, unpleasant odor when threatened." And this one closes with a quote from Dean Hammer in Living with Our Genes. And the quote goes, "The root of these responses is in the genetically determined chemistry of the brain, especially the primitive part of the brain called the limbic system. The limbic system is responsible for emotional behavior, the way people feel, by generating gut reactions, the most powerful drives, behaviors, and feelings, often the ones that feel beyond the control of consciousness. Deep in the limbic system are the roots of fear, aggression, lust, and pleasure." And from Daily Observations, Thoreau on the Days of the Year, Henry David Thoreau, edited by Steve Grant, Thoreau on March 8, 1859, wrote, "To us, snow and cold seem a mere delaying of the spring. How far we are from understanding the value of these things in the economy of nature." And on March 9, 1852, he wrote, "The sound of water falling on rocks and of air falling on trees are very much alike." Well, a couple weeks ago, I made a road trip down to Las Vegas to see my son and his family. There were several adventures outdoors in the sunshine and mild temperatures down there. And it's kind of funny, my hikes with him used to be at the pace of his aging dog, which was just right for me. And now the pace that's just right for me is his daughter, my grandchild, who's 3.5. Anyway, rains and snow had recently moved through the Red Rocks and Lake Mead, and we had a great time exploring both areas. On my drive home, I was on the 93 from Las Vegas and the 318 through Ely to Wells, Nevada. The Joshua trees along the way are just beginning to get the first of their waxy blooms. And there are several areas I want to explore when I have more time. The Paranagat Valley, for one. Do you ever have a place you think about going to or even something you'd like to do outdoors, but maybe would like a little beta before you set out? Well, we have a nice resource in our community I just found out about, and I'm going to let one of the founders tell you about it. Could you please introduce yourself and your group name and how you're affiliated with it?
Yeah, I'm Jeannie Wall, and I'm a co-founder of a women's organization called Broad Beta. You know, we have a website, broadbeta.com. We do podcasts, we do speaking events, and we have gear reviews specific to women on the website and some journeys with food and stories in that regard and some recipes. So,
okay, thank you. First off, why did you form this group? And then how did you get it formed?
So I formed it because I've spent my life in the outdoor industry making products for women and men. And COVID came. I stepped aside from some product development work I was doing because of location and other things. And I had wanted to do something for women specifically to basically kind of empower women and uplift women in our industry. It's still a very male-dominated industry, and the outdoor world is in general, especially in the sort of climbing, skiing realm. I mean, that's changed a lot in the last 10 years. But the original impetus was from women I worked with when I made product, and I would do these focus groups, and I would teach them about fabrics and such, and they were like, you should have a gear review business. And I'm like, I don't want to do a gear review specific to women. But then a friend of mine who I climb with, we did a couple big climbs on El Cap, and we started chatting and telling her about the idea. And then we started talking about sharing women's stories and like our story of climbing El Cap, which had some interesting things. Mm. And so then she was like, oh, we should do this. So it kind of gave me the kick I needed in the pants to get it going. And it became more about really sharing these journeys of mountain women, and how wilderness and wildness and our passion for these, you know, endeavors has changed us, transformed us. And they're all kind of the untold stories. And I wanted to bring them out. I wanted to share them. And so we started sharing them as written stories. And then we started audio version narrated those stories so you could take them on the road. And then we started a podcast. So getting folks to write a story is not always super easy right now. People are busy, and so the podcast became a great way to connect with a lot more women and get their stories. Albeit I love when someone writes about experience and, you know, their life through that experience. And so we're still always looking for written stories, and it's kept more toward mountain women and queer folks, those of us who are passionate about connecting with the natural world and wilderness, and have a passion for climbing and skiing and some of the others.
And you mentioned that your group kind of fills the space in a very male-dominated area. And so would you call the area that you work in largely climbing or just outdoors in general or what?
Well, I think the outdoor industry, specific to the work, is a very male-dominated industry. I mean, there's a lot more women in it now, but it still feels a little that way. I think the outdoor world is definitely there's all kinds of groups that get women out together, get queer folks out together, that allow for a lot more inclusiveness. I think that's opened up. And obviously that includes anything we do outdoors, really. And I think our focus has been trying to keep it a little more to the tribe of climbers and backcountry skiers. Mm. But we've interviewed women who became, you know, the first river guides. I mean, it's really a connection to wildness and how wilderness has informed us and formed us.
Do you have any long-term goals for the group?
For the org, I mean,
yeah,
I think my long-term goal is to see it kind of go viral, that more women pick up on this and want to share their story, whether it's at our events or the podcast or the written stories, but that it becomes more interactive, and it becomes something that like we all feel like is a way of communicating in a place where we can find our people and share things with vulnerability and openness that really help us all mm-hmm. get inspired or healed or have dreams or go after those dreams. So yeah, I think right now it's kind of like, I feel like there's a small group of us who are trying to orchestrate this and connect and bring in stories and do the interviews. But ultimately I'd like love it to take on a life of its own. I mean, it's a nonprofit. We started mm-hmm. as an LLC, but we switched it to a nonprofit because it's meant to organically grow. And if there's a need and we all want to hear these stories or share them, then I think it will, you know, start to ripple out.
I love that. Wilderness and the outdoors is such a great healer. Can you tell me why what you're doing matters to the environment, the community, or habitat health, any of those?
Yeah, I mean, the bigger picture I feel is that I think the more women take back their power and live their true selves and their true nature, I think the more connected we will be to the natural world, because it just feels inherent in the female psyche and hormonally and everything else. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's more of a communal, empathic, compassionate element to women kind of orchestrating and maybe helping on a bigger picture in the world, and the local picture, that feels gives me more hope that we will care about the environment, that we'll do something about the environment, that we'll find new ways to, you know, enjoy the environment, but not at the cost of it. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a bit of an organic element to women's connection, and I think that it's just been a very hierarchical, male-dominated world, if you will, a patriarchal world.
Yeah.
I think that's just a reality, and I think when you see women around the world who are, you know, whether they're running countries or orgs or businesses, it can be really a different feel. I mean, I spent 16 years at Patagonia, and when I started there, it was all women in management almost, and it changed my life. Like I came from being a tomboy and, you know, being around a lot of guys and being really competitive in sports and not having a lot of women mentors at all, if any. And I think working with those women and just the different feel of that, it opened up a whole kind of mind frame for me of like, it can be done differently, you know. I think that company, especially being, you know, Chouinard's really caring about the environment, also added to that, of course. But
nice.
Yeah, I think I do think that sharing these stories, to me, what's really important is the wilderness connection, and not mm-hmm. just like I summited this peak or I sent this route, or it's not about the trophy. It's about the experience and the journey we have in wild spaces and bringing out the wildness in ourselves. And I do think once we allow for that, that our lens opens to the natural world in a different way, that hopefully we care about it more and we want to do something. Are we directly doing something for the environment? No. I think it's more of a mind shift.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that makes me think of an article. There was a link on your website to an article that you published, I think maybe 24, maybe 25, but it was about ice climbing.
Yeah.
And I loved it. And it was so beautiful. Can you talk about where people can find that article or just the link that's on your website?
It's actually, the link is on the website. You can listen to it. I just did a narrated video if you want to just take it on the road or you know, while you're cooking dinner. And then I mean, it's pretty short, you know, but you can also read it on the website, and then you could just Google it via Big Sky Journal and all the images will pop up there too.
Okay, Okay.
Yeah.
And what was the title of that article? If people want to Google it, you know.
Yeah. It actually wasn't my title, although it's a fine title. We kind of worked, I did the story, and then they sort of pulled up a title, and I sort of let it ride with it. But it is called Dancing on Ice. Yeah.
Very cool. I loved that article. It was an eye-opener for me. Climbing has, I've never tried it, but when you talked about the experience, and also you said at that time it wasn't really discovered, as they say, yet, but now it's more popular and everything. But still, the elements in that article about your experience in such a beautiful wilderness or wild kind of place, it really came across well.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what brings me joy, you know.
Yeah.
Being in those places, yeah.
And I, being a woman, and I want to get out there and climb and everything. Yeah. And I think I would feel safe with your group, you know, learning. Because my big fright about climbing outside is, can I trust my belayer, you know? And
sure.
Yeah. And
yeah, I think that women, like, we don't do events. Our events are speaking events to share our stories, but but there are plenty of groups that teach ice climbing to women, and like our ice climbing festival in Bozeman. I have a big speaking event, but I also teach a women's only day, and those are great ways for you specifically to, you know, to get out there and be with other women and trust their belayers and have a great time. And it's always super inspiring to me to do that day, you know, and be there.
Well, my life's not over yet. There's still time to try it.
Yeah, you could for sure get in there and do it.
Yeah. Are there any events coming up that you'd like to tell us about?
We do have a more low-key, we call them broadcasts, where we have women come and share their stories in an evening event.
Oh.
It's going to be in Helena, and it is going to be, I think, March 28th. Let me just double-check here. That is a really good one. We'll be doing more of those, but that's the one that's coming up the soonest. That would be a good one. I mean, otherwise, I think just getting on our website, listening to the podcasts, reading or listening to the stories, and then just, you know, putting the word out there to people or letting us know, email us, let us know if you know someone who you want their story to be out there and you want us to interview them or share their story. So.
Nice.
Yeah.
And how can listeners learn more or support your group?
Getting on the website and on our YouTube channel and Instagram, just so that we can, you know, get the newsletter, signing up for our newsletter so we can figure out who's out there and reach more people. I think the internet's just really tricky these days with, you know, social media and algorithms and now AI. And I think our crux is just whenever someone gets on and finds us and listens or, you know, reads, they're really captivated most of the time. And it's just reaching people. So the more people can spread the word on their Instagram or their social media or get on our newsletter and sign up for, you know, hit the website, and that really helps us. You know, we're a nonprofit. I haven't done a lot to raise a lot of money. But obviously, the more our numbers, you know, the more the community grows, the easier it will be for us to just raise enough to sort of break even, which we're not doing quite yet. So that's always super helpful.
And I forgot to ask you, this is getting back to events. Are you doing the women's climbing camp this summer?
Oh, yeah. So we do a broadcast at the Women's Climbing Festival.
Okay.
Yes. And that will still go on. It's, I think, happening the weekend after Labor Day. So, yeah, we always do that. And if anyone wants to share their story, you know, and come to that event or the Helena event, they can email me or Broad Beta, and we'll get in touch and, you know, we can look at sharing their story or just come to the event and listen and enjoy and get inspired by other women's stories.
Nice. Okay. Let's see. Is there anything that I did not ask about that you want to be sure that our listeners know?
sending any feedback our way would be great. If there's things people want to see from us at Broad Beta, things that we could start participating in or doing, that's always really helpful. You know, what they enjoy the most, is it the gear review, is it the, you know, is it the written stories, the audio stories, the podcast interviews, do they want more food stories? I mean, any kind of feedback is always really helpful for us.
And speaking of podcasts, where would they find yours and what's the name of it?
It's just called the Broad Beta Podcast, and they can find it at any of their podcast locations.
Okay, great.
Yeah. And I think, let me just see, I think the event is going to be, I think it's March 27th.
That's the broadcast.
That's
at
the Helena.
Okay.
The Helena event.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, that's a, March 27th, I think 6 p.m. at the Stone Tree Climbing Center.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's a great way to sort of get engaged with this community and see where it takes you, and if you want to write or get interviewed or share someone else's, you know, help us share someone else's story. That's a fun evening. It's usually a social evening, and you meet lots of women and Queer Mountain folks, and then get inspired by some stories, some presentations. Yeah.
Do you ever do any event here at Spire at Bozeman?
You know, I've been trying to make an event happen there, and they sponsor the one we do at our Bozeman Ice Fest in December.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't put one together specifically at Spire, so that's a good reminder to try to make that happen. I tried to make it happen last year, and it didn't come together. So,
okay.
But yes, that would be a great venue, and they're super supportive, and we love supporting them. So
yes.
Yeah.
And would you like to share a meaningful personal experience that you've had in a wild place before we end?
That is a really good question. I should have had lots of them. I think, you know, one of the wildest ones I had was just being on Mount Logan on a big alpine climbing trip.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, like, I ended up, we were stranded at high camp on top of the plateau for five days, and I had my period with nothing. And I think it's just like, you know, those experiences of being a woman in that setting, and, and like back then I had, you know, I stuffed wool socks down my pants and, like, you know, for days, and then the tent smelled, and then my two male tent mates gave me a load of, you know, about it, and we laughed, and then I had to crevasse the socks on the way out. But I mean, just there's all these little things we kind of just have to suck up and deal with as women, especially in the mountains.
And, yeah, yeah.
You know, I think I also wrote a story for Climbing Magazine about climbing through menopause and just the craziness of that, and how we don't talk about it, and what it does to you physically and physiologically, and motivation and emotion, and, you know, still trying to climb hard or do whatever we do hard, or just a whatever level we want to. I mean, it affects us, right? And we don't talk about it. So it's an interesting journey, but it's still always worth being out there, for sure.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jeannie. I really, really enjoyed talking to you. And hopefully we'll have you on. Yeah, hopefully we can have you on again if something new comes up that you want to talk about. Love hearing from you.
I appreciate it, and I appreciate your interest. And maybe just shoot me a time when it will come out, and we'll promote it on our Instagram and website.
I sure will. Thank you.
Okay. Well, you take care. I hope you show up at our women's ice climbing event or the rock climbing festival.
Well, I might see you at the rock climbing festival, because that's coming up next. And I was strongly encouraged to go ahead and try it. I've always felt like I didn't even start climbing till after menopause, well after menopause.
Okay.
So I consider myself a forever beginner, but
awesome.
Beginner's mind is good. And anyway,
absolutely.
She said there were a lot of events there that were, you know, towards beginner climbers. And
yeah, it's a super inclusive, inviting, very comfortable place to be at any level, and I think especially at your level, like, perfect. You'll you'll feel good and you'll be inspired and it'll be a really good experience.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you. I love what you're doing. I really appreciate it, Roxana. You take care.
You too. Bye.
Okay.
Our background audio today has been, well, I guess the sounds of my yard and that jet going over. My thanks to Red, Blue, Black, Silver and to Ken Lane for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks all the volunteers, supporters and underwriters of KGVM, and thanks to you for listening. Do you have an adventure you'd like to share with us? I'd love to hear it. Leave a text or voicemail for me at 406-424-6246. This program broadcasts on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are archived for you on the kgvm.org website. Don't give up on more snow. We still need it. Watch those skies. Keep doing good things and sweet dreams. Stay warm and well. I'll leave you with this from Terry Tempest Williams. She said, "It's all hands on deck to keep the open space of democracy open." I'll see you next week.